This is the Upright Living Podcast. My name is Everett. I am here with my co-host, as always, Stephen. We have a special guest for you today. You might know her from her books. You might know her from her political YouTube. But she is someone I've been wanting to get on this podcast for a long time. She is one half of the author group known as T.S. Pettibone. And this is Brittany. Welcome to the podcast, Brittany.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure. I'm sorry I took so long.
Oh, that's okay. You've been busy. You've been defending Europe. You've been standing up for the little guy. You've been standing up for Europe, and I absolutely love that and respect that because I am moving to Europe soon, as some of our podcast listeners might know. But yeah, I've had a lot that I wanted to talk to you about, like, because your channel, since you and I last talked, which was I think February or something, your channel has really blown up. You've gotten a lot of great things happened to you, and you've also ended up on like the ADL terror list, which I thought was just hilarious.
Yeah, I don't understand the point of these articles. Like, what are they trying to? I mean, essentially, what they're doing is they're painting targets on the back of your heads because you know that lists like this are just going to, add gas to the fire in regards to groups like Antifa. So, I mean, I don't really mind. I think my parents were more worried about it than me, but.
Yeah, I was a little offended that I wasn't on that list, goddammit. But yeah, I was like, yeah, I've tried hard. I've been writing for like altright.com. Can't I end up on a terror list? But I guess not. Goals AF, but whatever. But yeah, like one of the first things I want to ask you, because you and I kind of talked a little bit about what you should do back in February when you messaged me over Discord, and I kind of gave you some advice that I don't know if it was good advice or bad advice in hindsight, but it was basically you can't serve two masters. Which kind of brings me to the question of, like, what do you view yourself as primarily right now? Are you primarily a writer? Are you primarily a political commentator? Somebody who is, you know, trying to save Europe? Like, how do you view yourself?
Yeah, I know. I kind of am a jack of all trades right now. You're right. But I think at this point, I am primarily a political activist and commentator. So I look at myself as a political activist who does some reporting. I don't look at myself as a journalist because obviously I'm extremely biased. I don't in any way lie and try and twist and create fake news, but I do have a certain angle, you know, from which I approach things and certain news that I like to report on. So I'm very open about that. And so that's what I would call myself, a political activist. Then on the side, I'm obviously a writer. The thing is, I love writing with all my heart. It's my biggest passion. The problem is, I just feel like there are issues that are more important right now. And if, you know, I could be spending my time writing a sci-fi novel. I have an amazing one that I've been wanting to write for so long. I've already finished 30,000 words, but I just kind of look at it as what's more important right now, what's going to be more productive and more useful to people. And it's politics at this point. But I still am, you know, carving out a tiny bit of time to write, although it's going to take me a while to finish a book at this rate.
Okay, so like one of the other things that I've been curious about, you know, people on the right, whenever they hear left-wing writers or musicians or whatever talking about politics or talking about, you know, open borders or whatever, like a lot of people criticized J.K. Rowling for, you know, speaking out on her opinion on the immigration crisis. And people on the right say this is going to hurt your book sales. That's why you shouldn't do it. So I'm curious what has happened with, and maybe this is, you know, not something that you want to talk about. That's okay if you don't. But, like, what has been the situation with your book sales from you becoming more political and more high profile? Like, have you seen an increase in your book sales? Have you seen a decrease? Has it not really changed?
It actually hasn't really changed. And this may be due to the fact that very rarely I ever talk about my book or promote it because I just don't feel like the two mix. I don't want to be that person that's, you know, seeming like they're only talking about politics in order to promote their book and you know, their status and all these things, because it's absolutely not true. So I like to keep the two separate. People, obviously, if they're interested in what I do, will might look into me and then see I have a book and then might be curious to, you know, in checking it out. But at this point, I've kind of put it to the side. It's on the back burner. Obviously, my twin sister and I will continue to write, but we're not going to be heavily promoting that at this point just because I figure that the political side is more important. So yeah, you'll rarely see me talk about my book.
Okay, but you are still writing Verdict Day, is what it's called, right?
Yes, and then I'm also working on a standalone sci-fi on the side, which I'm very excited about. Hopefully, I can get it done. But it's quite a beast.
What you got 30,000 words on, right?
Yeah, but it's going to be, it could be close to 200,000. I mean, I always take on these projects that are, like, insane.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I've written a 200,000-page book, and it is not easy. It took me almost 2 years worth of research and a year worth of writing to actually get it done. So I salute you for wanting to create anything that big. So you said
yeah, that's the thing, though. I actually want to say on that, like the fact that you, like I know you write fantasy too. Yeah, fantasy, kind of sci-fi.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is awesome that you put that much research into it, because there's this mentality among a lot of writers, and I've seen this being so heavily involved in the industry over the years, is that when you write science fiction and fantasy, you don't have to research because it's all creative and you make it all up. But actually, the more you research when you're writing sci-fi and fantasy, the better your book's going to turn out, because you can
Yeah, one of the things I'm doing right now is, like, I'm working on a kind of an agricultural science fiction, because people, when they write science fiction, they usually think, or space fiction, or space operas or whatever, they usually kind of think, oh, you know, how do we get faster than light travel? How do we come up with, you know, life support systems? But nobody ever really says, okay, how do we actually feed ourselves? And when they do, it's usually a cop-out, like, oh, we're going to use synthesized food. But, you know, matter can change forms, but matter cannot, and matter can become energy, but matter cannot be destroyed. That's the second law of energy. Conservation of energy, conservation of matter, and you need a way to feed yourself. So that's what I'm working on right now. I've been doing a lot of research into soil chemistry, soil physics, things like
that. Are you going to try and go for like traditional publishing, or are you going to just self-publish?
I might self-publish. I've been fairly successful self-publishing, but I recently submitted one of my old books to Arctos Media, because I've been writing for AllRight.com, and I kind of have gotten connections with some of the guys who run Arctos. And they are reviewing one of my books right now, my old book, Autumn Leaves, which is a historical novel of Japan. But I would like to publish with them, or maybe if I could, I don't know if they'll ever open submissions again, like Castalia House. That would be cool if I could get that. Like I know that Tara McCarthy just signed on with Castalia House, and so did Jack Posobiec, I think is how you say his name.
Oh, really? Yeah, actually, Vox and I have been talking about this. I mean, there's nothing set in stone. But perhaps we'll collab in the future with something. But at this point, I just don't want to make any promises, because I'm so busy. My life is like insane, so I can't really make a commitment on when I'll finish a book at this point. But I would absolutely be interested in that, because I mean, the traditional publishing industry, I've kind of like folded on any hopes of that at this point, because it's quite dominated by
SJWs. And the SJWs don't like you very much, because you report on their bad activities.
Yeah, they don't like me because I was very much a part of, I was getting to know a lot of the popular book reviewers, plus a lot of the popular authors. And so, you know, we were connected in this network on Twitter. That was my entire network. And as soon as I started becoming politically active, it was like, what, everyone axed, you know, contact with me, except one writer who I will not actually mention his name. He's quite prominent, but I don't want to, you know, people to go after him if I say his name.
Yeah, of course not. So that kind of brings me to another question, which is, I think you and I kind of talked about this like back in February or something, but like, what has been the fallout from you becoming politically active? I know that you just said a moment ago that you've lost contacts that you spent what, a decade making. So, you know, what has really been the fallout for you politically, and is there any hope in the big five publishing industry for conservative voices, for traditional voices? Is there any room for us in there?
Well, I mean, regarding the fallout, it was pretty quick. It happened in, like, you know, over the course of a couple days, but at the same time, there was this, you know, the same amount of support I received. So it didn't really faze me that much. Of course, I was a bit upset, because I had put so much into it, you know, like my blood and, you know, sweat for 10 years. But at the end of the day, I was like, I knew this was going to happen. You know, I'd be naive to even try and act surprised, you know. So, excuse me, it wasn't that big of a deal. But then regarding will there be a place for us in the industry, I would not hold hope that there would be. I think certain conservatives, perhaps, especially if they have a really big platform, or maybe if they're not really politically active, and then obviously you can get your foot in the door. But if you're really outspoken about politics, especially ones that these liberals really disagree with, I wouldn't hold your breath. But you know, you never know. You could have a book that's good enough, and they're just like, oh, we want to you know, run the risk and publish you anyway. But maybe, you know, kind of keep it on the DL what your politics are. So
yeah, one thing. Yeah. I've been, I was just tossing around this idea with John Della Rose like last night, and then with Everett too, is this idea to put together kind of like a banned books, I guess column on the Uprising Review, where just of authors that, you know, have found pushback because of their politics. And, you know, it was really interesting. John's really been following that, which is why I kind of roped him into it. But there was an author even a few months ago that was really being attacked by SJWs, but she was a very liberal writer. And, you know, so it's interesting. It's not always just, you know, based on necessarily ideology, which I guess mm-hmm. it really is, but it's not, you know, left or right, I guess, because I think as conservatives we always think, oh, it's, you know, the left is you know, pushing the right out, but often it's really kind of universal, which is something that really surprised me, I guess, as we
no that's actually a, yeah that's a really good point, actually, because they eat their own. I've seen this happen actually on numerous occasions. There, you have these quite successful authors. Usually, from my perspective, I saw they were young adult ones, and they would really try to pander to the audience. You know, include all the diversity, all the sexual orientations, all you know, have you know, fill in all the checklist essentially. And a lot of them would receive insane backlash for this, because people would be like, some people would be like, this is great. Some people would be like, you can't possibly understand the mind of a gay person. So how dare you write this? Or you did this wrong. You're misrepresenting this kind of race, or et cetera, et cetera. And they would just receive so much backlash for it. So despite them trying to do all of this, it doesn't work out in the end. The result ends in necessarily positive. Not to mention, when you have this kind of checklist, you are putting yourself in a box and you are completely ridding yourself of any chance to be truly innovative and creative, because you have to just fill it all in, and you're basically crushing anything that is organic when you write your book. So yeah, I never bend to this. Although personally, I do like to include some, to some extent, diversity in my book, because in our books, my twin sister and I, mainly because we love different cultures. Like, we have like Swedish, you know, like all across the board, yeah. Because we get kind of bored with the same culture, but we love, like, we have a ton of Japanese culture actually in our book. We think it's so interesting. So we do like to an extent include diversity, but it does come from a place of genuine passion of trying to understand and learn about other cultures, but it's not any kind of, you know, trying to push some kind of agenda. We were actually interested in this way before the whole SJW movement with diversity. So,
right.
That's something that, like, I've talked about on the podcast before, and I guess I'll kind of talk about it again, because I don't know if you listen to our podcast, but I have a friend who had a major publishing contract with one of the big five in New York, and he lived there for many years, and he ended up getting his publishing contract canceled. Because the first book he turned in, they said, okay, this is all white people, there's not enough diversity. The second book he turned in, like a year later, they said, okay, you're culturally appropriating other people, you don't need to be writing about these minorities. And what they ended up doing was was canceling his book contract, and now he's just shit out of luck. And I'm like, you know, how do you walk that tightrope between, like, if you're a white man, if you're an author, and he is a white guy, how do you say, okay, I'm not going to include white people, or I'm only going to include white people, and then turn around and include anything else without being accused of, you know,
exactly.
It's a no-win situation if you're a white male
yeah.
author.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. If you're white and you include only white characters, it's like, oh, you're racist. You don't have enough diversity. But then if you include other races, then, you know, if you have like a black character, for example, they'll be like, you can't possibly understand the struggle and the journey that they go through. So how dare you even try and write them? And it's like, what do you want from me?
Well, see, and I really that concept is just so perplexing to me, because as a writer kind of growing up, you know, I started writing in high school and things like that. You know, I was, I realized at one point, okay, I need to start really paying attention to people, listening to people and understanding who they are and, you know, how they think. And so I think that really comes naturally to most writers of fiction, just to really try to, understand people and to research, and like you were saying, to look up at other cultures and find out what they believe and what they do. So it really, I just don't get how you can make that jump and say, oh, you can't write about this culture because you can't understand it, when I think that's what writers are supposed to do.
Yeah. That's the equivalent of saying you as a woman cannot write in the mind of a male character because you can't possibly understand. It's like, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I don't get a lot of that, but I did write a book about another culture, but every great once in a while, I'll get an email from someone saying, how dare you write about my culture? You're not an Asian. You're not a Japanese person. Wow. How dare you write about this? And it's always kind of shocking. And, you know, I'm pretty a nerd to trolling. Like, because I get a lot of shit on other social media for writing for like altright.com, which I used to do, or for America.org or something like that. And people will say, you know, shitty things to me on social media. But every now and then I'll get an email, because I did include my email address in that book. And at the front of it, I said, hey, if you want to talk, email me. And people will from time to time say, you know, hey, you're not Japanese. You don't have any business writing about Japan. And my thought has always been, I'm not from the 16th century either, but how can I write about that too? Because one of the books I'm working on right now is, again, set in history, because I write historical fiction for some of it. How do I write science fiction? You know, because I'm not a scientist. I don't have to be a scientist to write science fiction. It's just stupid.
Yeah.
Well, I think most of the time, too, it's not even, like, say, an Asian getting offended because you wrote about Japan. It's usually more often than not.
Usually someone being offended on their behalf.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is the worst.
Yeah.
It's like no one asked you.
Yeah, I mean, it's usually somebody, you know, saying something remarkably stupid. But yeah, this is basically like a books podcast and stuff. And so I'm glad that we're talking about this, because rarely do I hear you talking about books. It's usually talking about politics. But like, so how do you... Like, how does this affect Nicole is something I want to know, because I never see her on YouTube. I never see her doing anything. Like, what does she think about the attention you're getting, and how is it affecting her?
Of course, she really likes what I'm doing. She thinks it's good. And to be honest, actually, I think she's going to start making a couple videos with me again. But she basically she only did it a couple weeks, and she's a lot more introverted and withdrawn than I am. So she really didn't want to take part in it. It was too much to handle. But she's kind of found a balance over the past couple months. She's been writing a lot, and she wants to start making some political videos with me again. And we're going to start that very soon, actually. But it's going to be nothing too much, too crazy. And then... The thing is, we both talked about it before we started politics. We had the conversation that this is probably going to be greatly detrimental to our writing career and everything we've worked for and our connections and everything. So we had the conversation, and we both agreed that it was the right thing to do. So we did it anyway. So any kind of pushback and repercussions for what we did, we both understand and accept at this point. But yeah, she still has been writing a lot, and I'm very excited for her to join me in a few videos soon, because obviously I love working with her.
Yeah, and I just saw a picture on Instagram, and I could have swore it was you and Nicole. You have a little sister that looks exactly like you.
Yeah, she's 20. She's 20. Wow. So we're a couple years older, but I always have to, when I post pictures of her, I have to clarify this is not Nicole, because a lot of people do think we look very similar. But I actually have, including me, there's 5 girls in my family.
Yeah, and you have 8 kids in your family, or is it 8 siblings?
Including me, there's 8 siblings. And then, my parents, obviously.
I thought that I had a big family, because I have, like, my grandmother has 9 brothers and sisters, so I have, like, 50 cousins, and it's just, I always thought that was kind of crazy. But yeah, to have siblings like that, that would be nutty.
It's so much fun.
I would imagine it, but you know, that's like one of the things that I'm kind of dealing with right now, is I'm going to end up leaving most of my family in a few weeks and just end up striking out on my own. But yeah, that is scary.
Are you excited?
Very, because you know, I'm going to be making pretty decent money. I got a good job with a good company, and I'm going to have a hell of a lot of writing time, I think. And you know, I think that, you know, this is going to be a good place for me, because living in the town I live in and being 40, it's very hard to get a date when you live in a college town and you're over the age of 25. So it's
I know what you mean. Well, actually, exactly. I don't, but I just imagine it.
Yes. I mean, it's when all the girls are 19 and you're like literally biologically and socially also old enough to be their father. It's definitely weird. You know, like all I want, like I realize that, you know, you know, whatever the manosphere doesn't like the girls that are 34, 35, but like, that's what I'm going for now. So, mm-hmm. you know, like I have no business dating a 21-year-old, but, and because they're just at a very different place in their life than I am.
Exactly. But, yeah. I think it'd be difficult.
It is. Yeah. And it's difficult to meet anyone. And like, that's one of the things I'm looking forward to in a really large, big city in Europe. Mm-hmm. Is,
yeah. Know, I'm excited for you. Congratulations.
Yeah, and I don't have to hang out on Discord with people all day long and, you know, talk shit about Bosnians.
Sorry, I miss our Discord chats. We used to, like, do it, it was, like, almost weekly or bi-weekly, and it was fun. It was Slav and everyone. Yeah, it's been a while, wow. But that was so much fun.
Yeah, Slav and Pill and I, because Hymet, we think, got Merkled. And
What?
We think Hymet got arrested at this point because he hasn't shown up in, like, 4 months. And he doesn't respond to any of my outreach to him, to my texts or my emails or anything like that. And I kind of know what his real name is, so I've Googled him. And, like, I can't find him online. I can't find him anywhere.
Oh, my gosh.
So we don't know what happened.
I'm sure if you Googled his real name, maybe there would be something about him being arrested. If he was, maybe he just decided to take a step back. But, that seems kind of weird. Maybe I'll try and send him a message, too. That's really scary.
Yeah, me and him were working on a project, and he just disappeared out of nowhere. We were working on this project, a podcast for me, where I was going to basically lecture on history. Because I don't know if you know, I don't remember if you remember this or not, but I, like, almost have a PhD in history, and I was going to just kind of talk to Europeans about European history and make them proud of it again, because he was telling me, you know, Europeans don't really
do remember
European history. Yeah, and like, he and I were talking about this, and we were going to do it, and then he just disappeared one day, and nobody knows what's happened to him. He hasn't posted on Gab. He hasn't responded to my emails or texts or anything, so I don't know what's wrong with him.
That's so scary. Oh, my gosh.
But, yeah, we think he got arrested is the theory.
Wow.
Because he was posting without a VPN from his work, and we think maybe they arrested him for that.
Oh, so. Wow.
That's like our best guess, and we know what the laws are like in Germany. And you have a sister that lives in Germany, so I guess you probably know what's going on there as well. But like, you can't even criticize immigration in Germany without getting arrested.
Absolutely, yeah. My sister, thankfully, though, is not politically active there. She's just living there for a few years with her husband and child. But So they should be safe from all of that. But I do know that I do have a very dear friend who lives in Berlin, and she obviously supports all the same things I do. And she even has like t-shirts and everything. But she can't say one word about what she really believes. She's wanted to even go to some of the events that they've held, but she knows that she's jeopardizing too much. So it really would be horrible to be in that situation. I actually can relate because I was in that situation for many years in the writing industry, but it was never like, if I say something, I might be arrested. You know, it was more like I'd lose social standing and opportunity, which is way less important.
Yeah, that's one of the things that, like, I've been talking to some people who live in Budapest who are kind of alt-right Budapest people. And, you know, they are affiliated with things like Arctos Media, and they're affiliated with the alt-right.com. And one of the things I'm learning from them is that, you know, a country like Budapest, which doesn't even have a First Amendment, is actually a freer country than the United States, because while we talk about having our political right to free speech, and we do, you know, we're not going to get arrested for saying I oppose illegal immigration or I oppose immigration to the United States, we can lose jobs. Like, the ADL will go after you. Liberals will go after you. They will get you fired. They will mm-hmm. lose. They will lose. You know, you'll lose your livelihood. That's what they do. They go after your livelihood now.
Didn't the ADL just partner with YouTube for the new censorship plan that they have about censoring offensive content? I heard that, and I was kind of thinking, they're probably going to come after me right away.
Yeah. So that's one of the things I also wanted to ask you. Like, you've seen that, so. Like, how do you think that's going to affect your livelihood? Because if you're mostly a political commentator now, if you're mostly talking about politics, and, you know, I've seen you on the Defend Europe missions, mm-hmm. You know, with Lauren Southern, like, what do you anticipate is the future for you as a commentator? Do you think you're going to have to start making your money by selling books, or is ad revenue and Patreon enough for you?
I mean, look, if I'm deplatformed, like from YouTube or something like that, I'll just look for a smaller platform, you know, similar to an alternative to YouTube and start there. Like, for me, it's not, if I lose my big base, then it's over for me, because it's never been about the big base. It's just as long as I have something to say, and as long as there are people willing, you know, to listen that are interested in listening, I'll do it. So, of course, it'll be a bit frustrating if I'm completely deplatformed, but then, you know, I'll just get up and start again. If like for now, I'm obviously, I think it's just moderate, you know, I can fund the kind of trips that I want to go on and, the equipment that I need and things like that. I'm obviously not making tons and tons, but, it's enough. It's just, for me to keep doing what I do. So it's, yeah, I mean, it's not about like making a ton of money. If it was, I probably would have stayed in the writing industry.
Which doesn't really make a ton of money anyway.
Yeah, but we actually did have a lot of agents interested and stuff in our book. Okay. We had six. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, there were some opportunities, and we had befriended some writers that were gonna read our book and maybe do like little reviews for them. You know, the little captions on the blurb. Thank you, the blurb on the cover, which really helps promote and those kinds of things. But I guess, yeah, both industries are fairly difficult to make money in. But I mean, at the end of the day, if that's why you're doing it, I don't think you're going to be helping people because it's just not genuine. Like if it's about your brand and your celebrity and making money, then I don't know. I just feel like for how important this entire situation is in the state of our country and everything, it feels pretty shady to make it all about that. You know, I don't really think about it. Like if worse comes to worse, like if I'm completely stripped of everything, I know I at least have my family to fall back on. They're great. But I'm really not planning in advance because things change by the day. So whatever happens, happens. I'm just going to do the best that I can do at this point with what I have. And yeah, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I don't know if you have been keeping up with Gab or not, because I haven't seen you on there much. But like Gab TV is now live and anybody who wants to can create a Gab program. And I was kind of thinking, you know, what if Uprising Review did a Gab program? Like we do 1 hour a week where we just talk to people and answer their questions. So do you think that something like Gab might be a viable solution for you if you do get deplatformed off of YouTube?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm sure I would do Gab. I would look, you know, even for others. The thing is that, and I love Gab. I miss Gab. I've just been so busy that, the thing is it got to the point where with politics where I was sleeping like a few hours a day and then working the rest. I wasn't hanging out with anyone. I wasn't even seeing my family, anything. And my life was, because I always tend toward the extreme that way. When I was writing for like 3 years, I held a schedule of writing 18 hours a day on the days that I wasn't actually at my regular job. So it was crazy. But I've gotten a balance now. So there are certain social medias I've kind of pulled back from a little bit just because I spread myself way too thin. And I try to make time for family, friends, and like relationships, those kinds of things right now, because I think they're very important and I don't want to ignore them just for the sake of all of this.
Yeah, and I will tell you right now, as someone who basically was a degenerate throughout my 20s and early 30s, you don't want to waste that time, because exactly. That's what I did. Like, you and I are from kind of different generations. I'm from like the tail end of Generation X. You're a millennial. Take it from me, if you do not succeed early on, like in your 20s, I'm not sure how old you are. I think you're like 24, right?
Yeah, 24.
Okay, yeah, I remember that, you saying that one time. I just wasn't sure when your birthday is. But like, if you don't find a good relationship, if you don't, you know, if you don't establish those connections in your 20s, you are going to find yourself like a lot of Generation Xers who are, you know, coming home to their two cats, which I don't have two cats, I only have one. So I'm only a half a cat man. But, you know, like, and drinking a glass of Pinot Noir every night and just wondering, okay, where are all the good girls at? And like, that's kind of where I'm at. So, you know, if you don't take the opportunity that you have to essentially, you know, capitalize on your youth, you are going to end up in a position unenviable. Let me just tell you that much.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I definitely agree.
And I think a lot of young people need to understand that, because the culture, so many times today, it tells them, you know, go out and party and have a good time. And hey, Generation X did that and we got screwed. So don't listen to us.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I've never really believed in that mentality. I mean, it wasn't like, well, I mean, I guess it kind of did to an extent, but it wasn't like I should party now and get married later. It was more like, I don't have time to get married. I just want to work. So I was like a workaholic. That's all I did. I didn't even have a social life for many years.
Yeah. 18 hours a day of writing is nuts, because I thought I was extreme with 5 hours of writing a day, but yeah, 18 hours a day, that is crazy.
I know. My twin sister and I are like robots.
So that's another thing I want to ask you, is a more literary question, which is, and I think I asked this because I interviewed you for my blog, A Natural Reaction, like back in October or something.
Oh, yeah.
How do you guys work as a team? Because, you know, I have to be a control freak and I have to be in charge of everything that's going on. But like, how do you guys work together? Do you have, do you say, okay, Nicole, you're going to write this character, this character, this character, I'll write this, this, and that. Or do you have chapters that you write each and just kind of, you know, how does it work?
Yeah, pretty much. So we actually have different offices. We used to be in the same office, but now we have different ones. What we do is we meet for meetings and we'll discuss the plot in detail. Everything's outlined. We have like the bare bones of the story. Then what we'll do is one person will write first and the other one will do in-depth editing and like reconstructing and, you know, sometimes changing, adding, whatever they want. Because we both really understand what the end goal is. That said, we, if there are two different character perspectives, usually she'll write one and I'll write the other, and then we'll switch and edit each other's work. So we have a really seamless method at this point that we've developed over the years. And it's, what I think is pretty awesome is when people read our book, they can't tell who wrote what. They think it's one author. And a lot of people think it was a man that wrote it too, which is, I think is interesting. I've been asked this numerous times if T.S. Pettibone is a man. So I don't know what to make of that. But it's a great working relationship.
That is awesome because, like, I have tried to write with other people in the past and it just doesn't work because I have my own style and my own methods. And The fact that you can actually get something done with your sister, like, is that twin power or is that just, you know, the fact that you understand each other on a very deep level?
Yeah, that's definitely a contributing factor. I think it's also, though, that we'd only each been writing, like, her maybe 2 years, me maybe 1 year before we actually teamed up and started writing together. So the vast majority of our writing journey has been one together as a team. So this is what we learned and what we know, and we developed our craft as a team. So that's why it's very easy. But then, yes, the fact that we're actually not very similar. We're kind of like opposites that complement one another. So even, you know, in personality, and then even when it comes down to writing style and everything like that. It's a great working relationship. I love it.
It's really interesting.
That's cool. I'm really glad you got that. Go ahead, Stephen.
I was just going to say, Everett and I are about to actually kind of try to put together because we've been talking to a lot of writers and giving a lot of writer advice on the podcast, and we've been talking about putting together a nonfiction book on like writing and marketing for writers.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, we realize there's not a whole lot out there.
We kind of need a way to support Uprising Review because when we started out as four, and we are effectively two at this point, and we just kind of need a way to put money back into it. And it would be great to be able to pay writers a little more for their effort and for their work because right now they're not getting a lot, but they're getting something.
Right.
But yeah, and also, you know, I've just always wanted, you know, to be able to write a book about, you know, like here's how you write, because I have read over a hell of a lot of years, I've read a ton of books on writing, and I know pretty much in depth about what I do, and I know how I work. And Steven is a marketing guy, so he knows how that works. And you know, like if you buy a book off the shelves off of Amazon about how to write a book, it never talks about the life of a writer and the pre-writing that goes into it and the research. It never talks about how do you engage in marketing in the 21st century. How do you sell your books?
Exactly. Yeah. That's the million-dollar question, you know, and when you can give people value like that, they're going to just eat it up. Like there are more and more and more nowadays people choosing the route of self-publishing. So if you can give them that value of how to market themselves and their book, because a lot of times you have to market yourself as well. And if you have a very eccentric, unique, interesting personality, people will be drawn to your book. But then also on the writing side, for me, and I don't know how this is for you, but over the years I've read dozens of writing books and I've hated nearly every one of them because the authors who write them seem to think that it's valuable to give you advice creative-wise. It's not. You need to completely stay away from that. You need to, when you write a book on writing, it has to be the very general advice that has nothing to do with creativeness, like structure, for example, it's kind of like math. There's no creativity in it. It's, you have it there, and every story needs to include it, and there's, you know, no discussion about it. So that's what I would suggest for if you write a book that talks about how to write. And yeah, research would be a great thing because obviously that is necessary. But I've read way too many books that are like trying to teach you, tell you what to do creatively, you know, and it's not a good thing. That's too subjective.
Yeah, and I've read a lot of those books as well because, like, whenever I was a teenager, I knew I wanted to write, but I put it off for a long time because I was doing other things, like being an academic and whatnot. But, like, there are two books out of probably 20 that I've read that I would say I actually learned anything from. And one of them is not actually a writing book. It's Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell. And the other one is The Art of Dramatic Writing by Lajos Egri. And neither one of which is about books, neither one of which is about creating, you know, how to create character, how to create atmosphere, how to do that. They're both basically very practical books. And except for the, you know, Joseph Campbell's book is about mythology. It's about the unifying things that make humans human. And it's ultimately about a building's roman, which maybe you'd be interested in that because you do write young adult and coming of age stories.
Please send me the link.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I will. And we'll include a link to it in the podcast as well. But yeah, I'll send you a link to the Amazon page. But it is awesome. Really good.
And if I could recommend a book, actually, the best book I've ever read on writing is The Anatomy of Story by John Truby. There are some other ones, too, but I'll just mention this one because I think that it is absolutely invaluable to any writer. He mainly teaches it as for screenwriting, but it's actually can apply to all mediums of writing, whether it be television, movies, books, whatever it may be. So it basically goes through structural writing. So how do you form a structure for your book? It starts with how you develop the premise all the way to the structure of your story. And then this is just essentially the bones, and then all the creativity and characters and events that happen, it's all the flesh, and it's up to you creatively. So it doesn't tell you what to do in that department. And it's really changed the way that I looked at everything in regards to writing, and I think that I progressed the most and became the writer that I am because I started studying John Truby. So I would definitely recommend that book.
Cool. I'll take a look at that. I haven't read that. When I was trying to be a screenwriter, because I used to want to be a screenwriter until I realized that screenwriters get treated like shit. And after 2 years of trying to be a screenwriter, you know, living in Hollywood, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to put up with this. I'm just going to go write novels. Because screenwriters just get treated like dirt. And, you know, if you're not from a specific neighborhood, if you're not from a specific university, like I went to a large public university, if you do that, they don't really like you.
With the writing industry, it's who you know. So, like, if you have a book that isn't necessarily that good, you can actually get probably an agent and at least some push behind your book, depending on who you know. Because, like, for example, in the YA industry right now, there's like a clique of writers. They all know each other. They're all best friends. Some of them even went to college together. And they're people who have been like, who managed to get an agent, and then we're like, oh, my best friend wrote a book. Can you check this out? And the agent will be like, sure, and then sign them on. And, you know, so they're all kind of in this little click that's very hard to penetrate and enter yourself and be accepted by. So I do know what you mean by that. And then I also think that that screenwriters are extremely undervalued. It's funny, when a masterpiece is written, people always credit the actors, and they don't realize that what the screenwriter might have gone through in order to create that. And it really is, it's all about the screenplay. If you have a bad screenplay, you're not going to have a good movie.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's one of the other things that I noticed whenever I was working on becoming a screenwriter was, A lot of it is just being in the room, because a lot of a screenwriter's job is not at all like a novelist job, because a screenwriter, people are going to invest tens of millions of dollars in your book. They want to know that they are making a wise decision, and a good portion of being a screenwriter is just saying, okay, yes, you can trust me. So that is very hard to do, and that is very much who you know as well, because you have to get invited to the party, and once you're at the party, you have to be in the room, and that is just a very hard thing to do, and that is where preferential treatment comes in. And that was one of the things that made me say, you know what, I think I'd rather just write novels, because I like novels. I like reading a hell of a lot more than I like writing screenplays. And even though I'm kind of good at writing screenplays, like I had an agent and stuff, you know, it's just not something that I wanted.
Yeah, honestly, I don't know much about the screenwriting industry. I don't know what the differences and similarities are with the writing industry and then the screenwriting one. But I do definitely know that that screenwriters are undervalued. I know that, and it's too bad, because they really are the most important part of a good movie being made or a television show. Like, yeah. Breaking Bad, for example, was just extraordinary, and it was because of the writers.
Yeah, and I love Breaking Bad as well. You know, I think that there's kind of a golden age in writing that's going on right now for television, and movies are just. You know, it's movies are just another pile of shit from Marvel.
I've said the exact same thing. That I think there's a golden age of television right now. So there's some great shows. Unfortunately, I haven't had much time to watch any kind of movies and shows in a long time. But Yeah, I loved Breaking Bad.
Yeah, that was a great one. There's not a lot that's going on right now that I really like, because I tend to avoid the porny stuff, like the HBO things, even though I know Game of Thrones is supposed to be great. Like, I don't want to watch lesbians, you know. I'm past that phase of my life. I don't need to see, you know, two women hooking up. So I don't really want to watch Game of Thrones. Like, the best thing I can say about that show is that they killed Ned before he had the opportunity to become a degenerate.
That's the thing. I'm truly drawn to stories because of their characters. I could, like, the plot doesn't necessarily mean much if the characters are good enough. So when it came to Game of Thrones, I got really bored because my favorite characters died and I just stopped watching it. So yeah. it's not that big of a deal to me. And I don't, I haven't watched it in many years.
Yeah. So that's one of the other things that I kind of wanted to talk about, because I love talking about this with other writers, which is, where do you start when creating a book? Because for me, it starts with characters. Because, for example, like Robin Hood or King Arthur or from La Morte d'Arthur, you know, most people couldn't tell me what century those are set in, or not even necessarily which country they're set in. But they know the character. They know the good characters. And every great book that I've ever heard of has really great characters. So for me, I start with the character. Like, where do you start?
Obviously, the first step is the premise, just like one sentence describing the actual heart of your book, of your story, what that is. But then from there, you can develop. Well, the thing is, and most people don't look at it this way, but this is something that I learned from The Anatomy of Story, is character is plot. Because every action that your character makes is the plot. So they are one and the same, essentially. So, yes, we start, we obviously have our premise, but characters come first for me. But obviously, I know the very, the spine of the story. And then events develop as I develop the characters, because I learn their personalities and what they're disposed to do and all those kinds of things. So it all comes together in a big web. You have to plan the character web, and it's a very difficult but fun process, I think. The science fiction book that I'm working on, the standalone one, I plotted the entire book down to chapter by chapter, and all of the characters and their arcs, and all the story beats, everything within less than 2 weeks. It was crazy.
That is pretty crazy. But yeah, character is plot. That is a very, that's a modern reiteration of Aristotle's basic premise from Poetics, which is character is fate. Mm-hmm. You know, the type of person you are determines the types of things that you can do and the types of things that happen to you. And so that's one of the things that I want to get through in the book Stephen and I are writing, which is, if you want to be a successful writer, you have to understand that character and plot are interchangeable, or not interchangeable, but they're intertwined. They are the same thing.
Really. Absolutely.
Yeah, no, I think the first story that I really wrote where I got super into the character, and I mean, it was just a phenomenal experience, just because I, you know, it's kind of like you were saying, I really understood that character, and then I started to take it, and it really drove where the plot went. And it was really a cool experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually find that the best characters that I write come out when I'm not too emotionally connected to them. You know, it's a character that I'm like, if it's right, I could kill them. If it's right, I could make them turn from a protagonist to an antagonist, you know, like a hero to a villain or whatever it may be. If I'm not too emotionally attached to that, my emotions are guiding them. If my logic is guiding them, they become way cooler and just completely take on a life of their own. So that's something that I think is really important. But then again, for a more amateur beginning writer that's not that seasoned, it's very difficult for them to do this. And it was impossible for me in the beginning. I was way emotionally attached to everyone. But yeah, I think that's important.
Yeah, killing your babies is kind of a, these days it's kind of a hackneyed thing, but even though everyone says, you know, you need to kill your best characters, and that's like de rigueur in writing books, is, you know, kill your babies. But I think that that's probably not necessarily a good idea.
I think it's stupid.
These days everyone who's making money as a writer is doing it by writing either the same thing over and over again, the same type of book, so they build up a following, they build up an audience. Like a romance writer, they always write romance. They don't veer off into science fiction one day and, you know, fantasy the next.
Yeah, I mean, if it's good for the story, sure, kill your darlings, kill your main character. If that's what's going to be the most effective and make the most impact and make for the best story, sure. But don't do it just for shock factor because people say to. That's ridiculous. But yeah, sometimes it's necessary, sometimes it's not. And I think just if you really understand your story, you'll know what the answer is to that.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the other things I was wanting to ask you, because you write young adult, which is very popular right now, but your story from Hatred Day, dealing with Snowford, this is a character, I think I'm saying that right, is Snowford.
Yes.
Yes, okay. And do you plan on letting that character grow with you over the years as you write it? Or will you see yourself in 5 years, 8 years, whatever it is, if you're still writing this story, do you see that becoming not a young adult book and just seeing her advance in age and maybe your fans advance in age with you? Is that something you plan on?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, we're going to – she'll age a couple years by the end of the series, for sure. Probably it won't be, like, you know, old age, but, yeah, she'll definitely age. We don't want to keep it all in, like, over the course of, like, a year, the entire series, you know. It does span several years. So, yeah, that's definitely how we're going to go at it.
Okay, cool. I don't really have a lot of other writing questions. I mean, Stephen, do you have any writing questions? Because we could talk politics at this point, because that is largely what Brittany is doing.
I guess it's kind of a writing question. It kind of brings it back into like culture a little bit. But, you know, you recently, and I saw one of you, just a YouTube video, I think it was a few months ago, that you put out on, you know, it's okay to disagree with somebody. And I think you put it out like before you talked to someone who was kind of controversial. And it's kind of strange. It seems this phenomenon. It's really came out, I guess, in the last year during the election. But for some reason, on any side of the aisle, we have this idea that we can't disagree with someone and like still be friends with them or still talk to them. And
yeah. I could say so much about this topic. I'm actually glad you brought this up. So I made a video called Why I'll Interview Anyone, because people seem to think that just because I'm interviewing someone, then I endorse all of their personal political beliefs, which is a ludicrous assumption, but people seem to believe it. I like to give everyone the opportunity to be, you know, people that I personally just find interesting, or they have, you know, something new to say, or sometimes they ask me and I'm like, sure, I will interview them. And it doesn't mean that I agree with or disagree with what they say. You know, like Tara and I agree on a lot of things, Tara and I disagree on a lot of things, but that's what makes it more interesting. And we're still very good friends. Yeah, I will stand by that, though. I like to interview anyone, and I'll continue to do so. I think it's ridiculous that people should try and shut you down because you're interviewing someone who might be controversial. I mean, if the ideas are that bad, why not let the person speak them, and then you dismantle them, you know, reasonably? Where's the fear? It's ridiculous. But then also, what was the second point you said?
I can't remember. It just seems to have permeated, like, all parts of politics on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Or even if you hang out with someone, like I don't have many friends that are completely different to me in regards to what they believe, but I do have a few, because they're people that don't care what you believe. They just like you for your personality. So, but people get so upset over this, and they're like, how could you dare hang out with that person? And I think it's ridiculous. It's like we're completely been boiled down to our political views, and there is no other facet of a human being. And that's what these people seem to think. But that's actually only a small part. Like, humans are very multifaceted. We're complex, or at least I would like to think so. Yeah. But that's what they boil it down to.
Well, and I think that leads so often to, you know, when people hear something, I think it's mostly on the left today, when they hear something, you know, they don't agree with. Like, I always bring up Geert Wilders, I don't know what he is now. He ran for prime minister of the Netherlands.
PVV is what he was in. His party the Netherlands.
People would always come out and say, "Oh, he's such a hateful person," when they don't think about, you know, the reason why he's saying those things.
Exactly.
Instead of that. They just personally feel like that thought to them, that thought process is hateful, when they don't really stop and consider, you know, what he's actually thinking.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Like, putting yourself in someone else's shoes and trying to look at the world through the lens that they're seeing it through. And I actually remembered the second part of your question now, how it's hard to disagree with people. That is very important. And you do see it. You know, there have been a couple, you know, recent instances of infighting amongst, you know, between the alt-right and the alt-light. And sometimes, you know, when people will step in and say, oh, I disagree, maybe, for example, with the alt-light in this respect, these members from the alt-light will get extremely mad and upset and cut them off. And it's kind of disappointing that we can't be at a point where we can give each other constructive criticism. It doesn't mean that we think you're stupid. It doesn't mean that we don't like you. People are very hesitant to ever speak out and disagree with someone in the network because they're afraid it's going to result in their friendship being completely destroyed. Obviously, I as much as possible, and all of the infighting that's happened, I've kept my distance because I really just don't want to get involved. I don't, unless I really feel like it's important, I will. But for the most part, I think it's a waste of time and energy. If I do disagree with someone, I wouldn't, you know, mind direct messaging them and telling them in a very kind way, but I just don't like this whole public kind of drama and everything. I'm really not that, I've never been that kind of person. It's very exhausting to me, more than like running 5 miles is, you know, indulging in this drama. It's horrible. I can't do it.
Yeah, like I don't really have the personality to deal with gossip. Like I'll make a mention of, oh, you know, my friend said this and that. But I don't really go into gossip, and I think that may be a guy thing. I don't know, because most guys I know don't really gossip or anything like that. It's usually the girls who are like, oh, do you know who she's dating now? Or it's, oh, do you know what she said? Oh, she put on 20 pounds. Isn't she fat? That kind of a thing.
Granted, so, I would prefer if you know, if you are going to constructively criticize someone just because you genuinely care about them. I think that it is best to do it like privately through direct messages. It's just what I would do, but obviously even if it is public, it's not like, at least in many cases that I've seen, maybe some it is, it's not really personal and out of hate. It's more like, you know, this is our movement and we need to keep it in line. We can't let it get away from us and contradict ourselves. And, you know, these kinds of things, it really is for the good of the movement, not to just, you know, go after people and attack them individually.
Yeah. So, Let me ask you, change gears here a little bit. I understand white nationalism, and I disagree with it. I understand ethno-nationalism and nationalism, but you call yourself an American nationalist, and that to me is that just another way of saying civic nationalist, or what does American nationalist mean to you?
I just hit my knee. This question, I don't necessarily believe that civic nationalism works, because ever since, like, if civic nationalism is based on the idea of equality and, you know, having the same ideology that everyone comes into and assimilates with, then it can't possibly work in our country now, because we have so many different ideologies, you know, that are quite large, that are competing and battling one another. Not to mention the second that these oppression groups were introduced, you know, a white person is, is an oppressive person, and a black person should be given more than a white person because they were, you know, oppressed in the past or whatever. The second these kind of groups were introduced, civic nationalism can't possibly work. But the reason I don't like to talk about these kinds of things is people look at it as, when I say I'm not this or I am this, they look at it as disavowing. So that's why I just like to stay away from it.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I just noticed.
No, that's the thing. Like I would like to talk about it, but people say, don't disavow. Don't say you're not this. So I just like to.
Yeah, no punching right.
But obviously, to be honest, I don't really know where I fit in, because I mean, I've said before, and this isn't, you know, disavowing, but I'm not alt-light or alt-right. That's why I say nationalist, because I don't know what I am. Being that I'm Catholic, it informs all of my political views. And so I find it hard to fit in one area fully. And so I'm just kind of, I feel like I'm someone on the outside looking in that obviously has the same common goals at the end of the day, like, you know, the big ones at least. So obviously I'm friends with people all across the board, but I've never identified as either one. And should there come along an ideology that I fully identify with, I won't be afraid to. I really don't like labels, but I wouldn't be afraid to take on one if I really fully identified with it. But I just don't with anything that's out there right now. So, you know, some people say I'm civic nationalist. Some people say I'm white nationalist. Some say I'm alt-right, alt-light, whatever. But I don't have any of those labels, because I look at my views as they're just too nuanced, I guess. And they don't really fit in fully with everyone else's. So yeah, I really struggle to define myself at this point. That's why I just say nationalist, because I mean, it might even change from that later, but I'm kind of, and also, can I just add to that actually really quick? Okay. A lot of people ask you to define things, you know, through identity politics. Like everything is looked at through the lens of identity politics right now, but being that I wasn't raised that way, and I think identity politics is a very new thing, and it kind of blew up as soon as I started becoming politically active. I'm not that, I don't feel like I know enough about it and have enough of a solid opinion on it yet to really comment on identity politics to the extent, you know, in a really educated way. So I've been taking some time to actually look into and study it. And when I reach a point where I do feel comfortable talking about this, then I will. But for now, that's why I kind of stay away from identity politics and then labeling myself too much. I'm very much on a journey of my own. So I think I'll reach that day at one point in time. But yeah. There's no labels right now. You can call me a nationalist, but that's about it.
Yeah, so you're kind of like in the Ramsey Paul school of political thought.
Well, I see him on Twitter, and he has some great tweets, but I don't know too much about him, so I'm not sure.
You should watch his videos. He's like basically – he was alt-right for a long time, and then he kind of pissed off some people in the alt-right, so now he just calls himself a nationalist. But you should definitely watch his videos.
Okay, I will.
That's kind of – he's actually kind of one of the people that impelled me to move to Hungary. Because, like, he really loves it, and he makes videos about it and talks about it, and he makes videos with other people and, you know, Hungarians. And I was like, you know, I want to be there. I want to live there. And, you know, that's kind of where I want to restart my life at. But, yeah, you should definitely check out Ramsey Paul. He's great.
Yeah, I definitely will. Thanks for that. And, yeah, I mean, I really wish, like, at the end of the day, look, most of us in this political movement, we're very different, even down to like what we believe religiously, our upbringings, you know, all the details of our beliefs. So I really don't understand why it's so hard for some of us who have certain differing political beliefs, like all across the right, we disagree on certain issues and agree on issues. I don't understand why it's so hard for us to work together, because at the end of the day, like the things that we're battling are extremely important, and we do have very large goals in common. So I really wish there could be more unity, and there's no one in this movement that I hate, and you know, I'm willing, you know, to work with people. It doesn't necessarily mean you agree or disagree on everything, but I don't get why there's so much controversy about it. Yeah. Kind of uniting the right. I mean, ultimately, isn't it, we have, you know, a lot of people to fight that are really big, and more organizations, extremist ones popping up to try and shut us down. So I don't think it does us any good and makes us very effective when we're fighting each other.
Yeah, like that organization Hope Not Hate. I've seen them.
Oh my
like,
gosh.
Like I've seen what they're doing, and like I know you just reported on Defend Europe, and you probably saw them in action maybe. Or
yeah, they're the ones that have been on our tail the entire time. They're the ones that lobbied to get Lauren's Patreon shut down.
Okay.
These people are insane. They wrote a story that the Sea Star, which is the ship for the Defend Europe mission, they said it was trafficking migrants.
Which is like, the exact opposite, kidding? Because it's the NGOs that are trafficking.
It's psychological projection, like, again. But just the stuff, it started with actually weapons, then it was drugs. They even brought those dogs on, you know, the sniffer dogs, I don't know what you call them, to search for drugs. And then it was migrants, and actually the captain and some of the crew, not the Defend Europe crew, but the hired crew, were arrested. They were eventually released. But, like, the whole thing is ridiculous. And, you know, have you seen the articles coming out recently? Like, CNN just put one out, I think it was yesterday. They said Italy's going to deploy 2 military ships to Libya in an effort to deter illegal migration and human smuggling into Europe. So they're even admitting this now. There is a big problem. And that this obviously means the Defend Europe mission is very important. It does have a point, but people aren't going to admit it.
Yeah, and like from what I've gathered, because I've been watching your videos and I've been watching Lauren Southern's videos on Defend Europe recently over the past couple of weeks, and it seems like all they really want to do is shine a light on what's going on with the human trafficking and with the invasion of Europe, which, let's just be honest here, there is no two ways around that. These are young military age men that are coming into Europe and essentially leeching off the system. They are invaders in no uncertain terms. But they're doing the exact opposite of what Hope Not Hate is accusing them of doing. But, like, I've seen this website, and I forgot the name of it right now, but it's a website where you can kind of track ships. And they're not even pretending to rescue these people in the high seas. They're just going into Libyan waters, picking people up, and dragging them back to Italy. I mean, it's insane.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's crazy, and that's what they're trying to do. And the really scary part is, look, these guys are – they really are genuinely risking their lives, because they're going out there and they're threatening the – you know, however many millions upon millions of dollars this industry is of trafficking migrants. And, you know, these traffickers out there are making bank on it. And so they're essentially threatening to expose this. They're going out there to document this, that that's the point of the mission. So it's a really worrying, concerning thing. Obviously it's very brave of them to do this, but I'm very worried about them. Yeah. I've been worried the past like week, and I just want it to be over already because it's horrible worrying like this, but
Because it's very dangerous what those Defend Europe guys are doing. I mean, because they're being accused of all these crimes. And like, I think Spain actually accused them of piracy at one point, didn't they?
Yep, absolutely. That's actually why Lauren and I decided not to go on the ship, because we were initially obviously invited to document the mission on the ship. We only did it before until they left. So we decided not to, because obviously there could be some massive emergency. There could be a crisis, some life or death situation. And we didn't want to be, obviously we would be the, you know, really vulnerable in that situation, and we would need them to protect us and these kinds of things. And we just felt like we would be a hole in the mission. We would be the weak link, so to speak. So we decided, no, it's best, at least this, because this is a trial run. It's the first time, that it should just be the men. And then maybe in the future, particularly if they get more ships, then maybe we'll go out and kind of report and document what's happening. So I think it was a really good thing that we went there and reported on the truth about what they're trying to accomplish, and kind of, have a lot of English videos about it, because the mainstream media was completely misrepresenting this whole thing. I mean, they were even, you had BuzzFeed, like HuffPost, I think even journalists flying to Catania, Sicily, where we were, and like, just for interviews. Antifa were getting tickets to fly over there in order to block the ship when it docked. It was insane. It was crazy. Yeah,
that is wild. But yeah, I know you have to go pretty soon, and we thank you for being here, because, you know, yeah, your hour's up, and I'm glad that you're here. You're always welcome back on our podcast. And I'd love to have you back on whenever your next book comes out, because I'd love to talk to you about that as well. Verdict Day is the name of the book you're working on.
Yeah, sweet, absolutely.
So yeah, where can people find you, Brittany? Where can people find you online?
Online, the best is, well, if you're interested in my book, then tspettibone.com, that's the website. You can get all the links there. But then politically, on Twitter, I'm at Britt Pettibone. My Facebook is Brittany Pettibone, and my YouTube is Brittany Pettibone. So, yeah, those are the places you're most likely to find me.
Okay, so yeah, again, we thank you for being here. I'm really glad you were able to get on the program. If you want to get on a Discord, because Slav and I set up a different Discord after Hammett got Merkled.
Send me a link, and when it, if I have some free time sometime, then I'll hop on, because I love chatting with you guys. It's always fun.
Yeah, so it's like Slav, Kebab Remover, and I have all set up a different Discord. And, you know, like I said earlier, if you're ever in Budapest in the region, I'll be there in about 2 weeks. Definitely stop by and see me.
I'd love to.
Yeah, and you can actually see what I look like for once, because I swear I don't look like my little avatar. I just thought it was funny. But I'm actually...
I know, the mind subconsciously starts to believe that, though.
I'm considerably taller than my little avatar. He's a fourth grader. But yeah, like, and maybe, I don't know, I'll start a YouTube channel, but I'm really skeptical about it with them going after content providers. But yeah, thank you for being here, Brittany.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Yeah, absolutely. For Stephen Willis, my name is Everett, coming to you from the Mos Eisley Taco Truck. We thank you for being with us here. You can reach us at podcast@uprising.com for our emails. We love hearing from you guys. If you are listening to us on iTunes, you can rate and subscribe. We appreciate that. And I think Stephen is actually going to put this one up on YouTube, so that would be great as well. Yep. If you're listening on YouTube. And if you like this, tell a friend. We really want to hear from you guys. And yeah, we have some great things coming for you in the future. Stephen and I have picked those things out. And yeah, I'm going to have to like get Vox's email from you, Brittany, or something like that, because we'd love to have him on the program as well. But yeah,
sure, so I can ask him on your behalf, no problem.
Okay, yeah, we'd love that. So yeah, you can check her out at Virtue of the West. That's Brittany Pettibone. Check out her book, Hatred Day. Verdict Day is a sequel that will be coming out this year, 2017. Thank you for being with us, Brittany. For Stephen, I'm Everett, and we are out of here.